Sokolowski. Unfortunately, the mosquitoes aren't asleep. We dash for the tent and zip ourselves inside. There's not much room to move around. Snug is a polite way to describe it. Father, son, and stepdaughter packed together like sardines. For some reason, it was easier to talk in the car. Now that the Panther mission is over, I'm not sure what kind of conversation to start, if any. By the glow of a battery-powered lantern, Summer and I each tap out goodnight mom texts. Dad's listening to a voice message on his phone.
Expletive, we hear him mutter.
What now? I'm wondering. He tosses the phone into his duffel.
That was my, informant.
Summer sighs. You can say her name. We know who she is.
Lincoln Baxter isn't driving straight home to California like I thought.
Then where's he going? I ask.
He told his wife he's got some unfinished business in Montana. To me, that sounds like another grizzly hunt.
Summer elbows me in the ribs. We're both thinking the same queasy thought. What if his unfinished business isn't a bear? I say to my father. What if it's you?
16. Mom liked the picture of our old house in Everglades City.
I knew it was sturdy, she said.
I saw your eagles, too.
The same ones, Billy? They came back?
Just like I told you they would. And they made it through the hurricane just fine.
Well, that's awesome.
Here's the roster at lunch. Me, Mom, Belinda, Summer Chasing Hawks, and Dad.
Summer and Belinda are seated next to each other, a little awkward because they've got almost nothing in common and completely opposite opinions of my father. Meanwhile, Mom and Dad are directly across the table from each other. She looks at him more often than he looks at her. There wasn't much he could reveal about our so-called camping trip, so that strand of conversation lasted about 2 minutes. Now it's mostly small talk, and Belinda acts like she'd rather be at the dentist. When Dad congratulates her on the Cornell scholarship, she pretends it's no big deal. He says,
"You should come out to Montana before college starts. Your mother, too. Billy said he mentioned it to you."
I did. Belinda's reaction was chilly. She makes a bored face.
Right, there's so much to do out there.
We can float the river, hike in the mountains, says Dad. Do you like to ride horses? Come on, I'll take care of the plane tickets.
Mom looks interested. Belinda grunts.
Trying to be upbeat, Summer starts chattering about the golden eagles, how huge and graceful they are. Mom gets pretty excited, as expected, and fires off a bunch of questions about the birds. What's their wingspan? Do they mate for life? Do their nests blow away in a blizzard? My sister just glowers at the half-eaten burrito on her plate. I'm not saying much because my mouth is crammed with food. The long ride home from Chokolowski made me hungry as a horse. Along the way, Dad stopped at an electronics shop in Fort Lauderdale to buy a new quadcopter. He picked a super expensive model, but it's still not waterproof. Mom is very curious about the Crow Indians, so Summer gives a brief history of the tribe, the reservation, and her family. At last, Belinda seems to be paying attention. Dad and I go outside to assemble his new drone. This one is black.
He downloads the control app onto his phone and mine, promising a future flying lesson.
Out west would be the easiest place to teach you, he says.
You'll be too busy for that, with Baxter hot on your tail.
Billy, how would he ever find me?
He slashed the tires on your truck, so he must have seen the license plates.
So what? Only cops can trace a private tag.
Can't you find another poacher to spy on?
Baxter's number one on my list.
Then go after number two, I suggest.
Number two is temporarily out of action. He fell out of a tree,
Dad,
after shooting himself in the foot,
Dad, you need to be more careful.
I'm always careful.
For a test flight, he sends his new drone cruising across the Indian River to peek at Mom's bald eagles. The high-res camera finds one of them sitting on a limb overlooking a small bay. The other bird is probably in the air scouting for fish, or for an osprey clutching a fish. Baldies are master thieves. Dad guides the quadcopter back to our neighborhood and smoothly lands it in the backyard. As soon as we enter the house, Mom announces, "It's a done deal, guys. We're flying to Montana next week." I'm not sure who's more stunned, me or my father.
"Next week?"
he says. I can tell what he's thinking. He'd rather have us visit after Lincoln Baxter is out of the picture, safely back in California. Apparently, while Dad and I were outside with the drone, Lil called Summer, and my mother asked to speak with her.
"What a cool lady," Mom says. "I told her about your invitation, Dennis, and guess what? She knows a motel where we can stay for 20% off. There's even a laundromat."
Belinda is nowhere in sight. She's probably fuming in her room. Dad says,
"Honestly, I was thinking more of August. It's one of my favorite months."
"August is going to be way too crazy around here. So much shopping for Belinda's college wardrobe. She owns basically no winter clothes, not even a hat. No, Dennis, I think now would be the perfect time for us to come."
"What about your gig with Uber?"
he asks.
"Oh, they're super flexible."
"But don't the kids have summer jobs?"
Mom says, "Don't worry, we'll get all that stuff worked out." My father caves. This was, after all, his idea.
"Chrissy, you're gonna love it out there," he says.
"I know! I am totally psyched to see my first golden eagle."
Summer glances up from a bowl of ice cream and smiles at me. I'm glad to be going back next week. The sooner, the better, especially with Lincoln Baxter unaccounted for.
"Let's hit the road," Dad says to Summer. "It's a long drive home."
There's always a waiting list for part-time jobs at Publix. Mr. Voss says that he'll have to fill my position, but that I can reapply at the store when we get back to town. It's pretty much what I expected, and truthfully, I'm not heartbroken. I'll miss the extra money, but not the social demands of bagging groceries. On my way out of the store, I spot Chin and his father again. I try to slip by with just a wave, but Chin sidesteps quickly, blocking my escape.
"Sup,"
I say.
"I've got something for you."
Okay.
"Can we go outside?" he asks.
I accompany them through the busy parking lot to one of the striped safety lanes where people drop off their shopping carts. Privacy isn't as crucial as avoiding bad drivers. Chin's dad hangs a few steps back, arms at his side. From the way he's looking at me, I know that he knows what happened in the D5 hallway, that I'm the one who saved his son from the loser lacrosse player. It's ancient history to me, though obviously not to Chin and his family. The kid says,
"I was afraid you didn't work here anymore. We haven't seen you in a couple days."
"I went camping with my father in the Everglades."
"Sweet," Chin says. "We're going to Yosemite in July. Dad rented an RV."
"Sweet."
"Here. Hope you can use this."
A handmade pocket knife is what the kid gives me. A coiled rattlesnake is carved into the polished wood handle. Etched on the other side are the letters B.A.D. My initials, Billy Audubon Dickens. This blows me away. I open the knife and use my thumbnail to test the impossibly fine edge of the blade. It feels sharp enough to split a hair.
"This is crazy," I say to Chin. "It's not like you owed me anything."
He's grinning because he sees how much I like the gift.
"The reason I had them put your initials on it," he says, "is so you couldn't give it back." I've got to laugh. Thanks, dude. Carefully, very carefully, I fold the blade closed. Chin's father says, Billy, you did a brave thing. Nope. I did the only thing a person like me could possibly do, wired the way I am. No way could I stand there watching a small kid get pounded by a big kid. Not an option. That isn't bravery, it's just reflex. Pedaling my bike down the street, I feel the weight of the knife in my pocket. It isn't as large as the one Jammer carries, but it's heavy enough for me. When I get home, my sister announces that Dawson broke up with her. You happy now? She says. All because of this stupid trip out west. Dawson says he can't do long-distance relationships, even for a week. I thought you were going to dump him anyway. So what if I was? You should be celebrating, I say. He's a creep. He tried to shoot Mrs. Gomez's cat with my slingshot. Muffin? You liar! Dawson wouldn't hurt a flea! But Belinda knows I'd never make up something like that. I predict you'll get over him, I say, by lunchtime. She stomps to her room and half-heartedly slams the door. Dad and Summer are making good time, she texted me from somewhere in Alabama. Mom is working an Uber job, driving an elderly person to a doctor's appointment. I'm okay with her taking riders like that. Something's been bothering me ever since we got back from Immokalee. I dial the phone number I'd memorized from the scrap of paper in the Range Rover. He answers on the second ring. Good morning, Rusty, I say, pleasant but firm.
Who the expletive is this?
My name isn't showing up on his caller ID because I blocked it using *67. I remind him that we met on the ranch road 2 days ago, in the presence of a sheriff's deputy.
How'd you get my number?
He demands angrily. Same way I got your name. Your buddy Mr. Baxter ought to be more careful. By the way, did you ever catch up with him?
None of your business, Rusty snaps. What the hell do you want?
Take it easy. This is just a courtesy call.
Huh?
A courtesy call. To warn you, I say, about what's going to happen if you try to set up another panther kill.
I got no idea what you're talking about.
Rusty's indignant tone is fake and shaky. He's worried. If you ever do something like that again, I say, whether it's for Baxter or any other low-life poacher, I'm gonna call your boss and get you fired. After that, I'm gonna call the game wardens and get you arrested. Whatever money you have in the bank, you'll be spending all of it on lawyers. And even then, you'll probably end up in jail for a couple years. But listen, there's another path. A smarter way to go.
Like what? Be a rat snitch?
No, it's real simple, I tell him. All you've got to do is make sure nothing bad happens to any of the panthers on that ranch. From now on, Rusty, you be their guardian angel. Chase off anyone who tries to mess with them or call the law. Can you handle that? I know you can. Rusty simmers on the other end of the line. Then,
why should I listen to anything you say? You're just a dumb kid. Anyway, who's ever gonna know if one of those cats gets shot way out in the middle of nowheres?
Here's where I'm prepared to do a little exaggerating. Okay, major exaggerating. Rusty, we've got a network of secret informants and a whole fleet of high-altitude drones. If one of those panthers gets even an itty-bitty hangnail, we'll know about it. I can sense the ranch hand doesn't like the idea of being spied on. He says,
is this, like, blackmail or something?
It's not blackmail if you're being made to do something honest. He chuckles glumly.
I don't see where I got much of a choice.
It sounds like your heart's not in this, I say. Just forget I even called. You go ahead and take your chances.
Now hold on! I'll do it.
What happened at the ranch shook up Rusty pretty badly. He didn't know it,
but he was ready for a phone call like this. Deep down, he's probably relieved.
"One more favor," I say. "If Lincoln Baxter calls you back..."
"That ain't happening, kid. I'm the last voice on earth that man wants to hear."
My mom and dad share the same view on the whole religion thing, which is simple. Everybody gets to make up their own mind. Is there a God? What's his deal, or her deal? I'm not sure what I believe, but the more I see, the more I wonder if God is taking a hands-off approach to the human race. How else can you explain so much bad behavior? I think it's very possible God got totally disgusted with us and said, "I'm done here. You poor dumb mortals are on your own." Working at a grocery store, you meet lots of nice folks and see many acts of kindness, but you also witness scenes that make you wonder if our species is evolving in the wrong direction, backward into the ancient slime we crawled from millions of years ago, when we were just innocent little fish growing legs. I remember a Saturday morning when two women got into a shrieking fist fight in the produce section. Each of them weighed like 92 pounds, and both were old enough to be somebody's grandmother. In fact, they probably were somebody's grandmother. The women had been chugging toward the same rack of ripe melons when their shopping carts collided. They argued, cussed, squawked, and then started to scuffle. Mr. Voss went on the PA system and told me to hurry to produce right away. By the time I got there, the old ladies were clobbering each other with cantaloupes. I separated the women and steered the loudest one to a neutral aisle. The melon she clutched was cracked and leaking like an egg. A policeman who showed up could hardly keep from laughing. Because this happened on Christmas Eve, okay? Supposedly the holiest, most peaceful time of the year. I realize a melon fight between two old crones is just one small, stupid incident, but it's still a lousy advertisement for the human race. Can you imagine God looking down and beaming with pride? No way. Meanwhile, check out the daily stream of bad news, if you can deal with it. Terrorist bombings, massacres, loony dictators, crooked politicians, hackers, scammers, bigots spewing hate all over the internet. Sometimes it's hard to feel much hope for the planet. My personal remedy, Belinda calls it my disappearing act, is to go places where I hear bugs buzzing instead of cars speeding down a highway, places where birds outnumber tourists. Solitary escape isn't easy in Florida because it's so insanely overcrowded. Depressing true fact, 20 million people live here. That's 19 million more people than live in the entire state of Montana, which is actually twice as big. No wonder I can't wait to go back.
17. The landing in Bozeman was bumpy, though Mom didn't seem to notice. She couldn't stop talking about all the huge mountains out the window. Even my sister was impressed. Now, 2 days later, everyone's doing fine. I wouldn't call it a miracle, but I'd been expecting some tension. At first, Belinda was crazed because of the lame Wi-Fi reception, but she's adjusting. Instead of checking her social media every 3 or 4 minutes, she now waits like half an hour, sometimes even longer. This is major progress. The first night, my father took us to the Ribbon Chop House in Livingston. Lil sat on one side of him and Mom was on the other. Dad edged his chair back so that the two of them could speak past him, directly to each other, which they did. All during dinner, he kept smiling, proud of himself, I guess. It's a busy joint, so I couldn't pick up everything Mom and Lil were saying, but I got the impression they were trading battle stories about raising teenagers in the modern world. Meanwhile, Belinda and Summer got into a deep conversation about boys, how impossible they are, and so not worth the trouble. That left no one at the table to talk with me,
which was fine. I was glad to be back in Montana, and there wasn't much else to say. The second day was a long, lazy Yellowstone float. Dad borrowed a friend's raft, and we followed Lil's drift boat downriver from the put-in at Carter's Bridge. Summer rode with us, while Belinda and Mom went with Lil. Dad showed he was pretty good with the oars, though not as strong as Lil, which he's the first to admit. It was a clear, bright morning, breezy enough to keep us cool. An hour into the trip, we heard Mom's voice rise excitedly ahead of us.
"Jackpot," my father said with a wink.
We could see Mom standing in the bow of Lil's drift boat, aiming her iPhone up toward a rock wall where a golden eagle posed motionless on a pale ledge. Mom was too far to get a good photo, but she eagerly clicked away, her shouts skipping across the open water. She was truly overjoyed to see that bird. It never spooked or even flared its wings. Dad said they get accustomed to the sight of humans, especially in the summer. That night, Lil fixed a huge dinner, salad, corn, and spaghetti served with meatballs made from real ranch bison. I demolished two monster helpings. Mom was still hyped from the river trip, and even Belinda was in a decent mood, probably because some dude dressed like a rodeo cowboy had stopped to flirt with her in the parking lot of the Albertsons. I rolled with the chill family vibe, thinking that maybe my father was right after all, that it actually was a great idea bringing Mom and Belinda out here to connect with his universe. But now, right this moment, not so sure. I'm standing outside the hardware store on Main Street. My father is inside buying water bottles and extra bear spray for a hike to the Pine Creek Falls with Mom and my sister. The reason I'm on the sidewalk is that I've been trying to get a phone signal so I can reach Lil, who's floating the Yellowstone this morning with a couple of trout fishermen. Dad wants me to ask her how much fencing she needs for their backyard garden, which is getting raided by hungry deer. Finally, my phone screen shows three bars. I should be dialing Lil, yet instead, I'm staring at a dirty black Range Rover parked down the street. There's a sticker on the rear bumper, but I'm too far away to read what it says. The vehicle stands out among the local pickup trucks and tourist rental cars, not only because it's too fancy for a small western town, but also because of its unusual condition. The Range Rover is cratered with dents from one end to the other. Plastic garbage bags have been duct-taped across the window openings where glass used to be. The SUV looks like it was attacked by a person swinging a crowbar or a baseball bat. A person who wanted to make a point, and whose name might be Rusty. That would explain why the ranch hand assured me that Lincoln Baxter would never call him about another panther hunt. He must have caught up with the poacher during that road chase through Immokalee. I hurry inside the hardware store to tell my father, who's waiting in line to pay. By the time we walk out, the Range Rover is gone.
"What if it's Baxter? What if he's looking for you?" I ask.
"Billy, the guy has no clue who I am or where I live. If he's here, it's because he came to shoot a grizzly. He might be heading back to Tom Miner or maybe down to Jackson Hole, if that was even his car you saw, which I doubt."
Still, Dad agrees to snoop around, just in case. Riding in the pickup, we cover all of downtown Livingston in about 6 minutes, and that's moving slowly. There's no sign of the damaged Rover, so we head back to the house and pack for Pine Creek. I'd assumed Summer was coming along, but she's staying home to finish chapter whatever in an online American history class. When I pop my head into her room, I see Sparky, aka Satan, curled up at the foot of the bed. The mangy old cat is snoozing on the windowsill.
"Have fun on the hike," Summer says. "It'll be good for those scrawny Florida legs."
Pine Creek is a dream trip for my mother, though Belinda keeps complaining that her feet hurt. After reaching the waterfall, we sit on the smooth, slanted crown of a boulder to eat lunch, ham and cheese sandwiches and apples. Mom loves watching the mist rise from the cascade. She says somebody should bottle it as skin moisturizer. The forest shade smells rich and piney, and the tourists are behaving. Some of the locals brought along their dogs, so Mom made lots of new friends on the trail. On the trek down the mountainside, we step around a fresh pile of berry-filled poop that Dad says came from a black bear, not a grizzly. I trust him to know the difference. Belinda says a bear's a bear, and suddenly her feet don't hurt anymore. She's moving faster than all of us. On purpose, I hang back, because Mom and Dad are walking and talking side by side, and I don't want to be an eavesdropper. From the soft tone of their voices, I know the conversation isn't an argument, but I can also tell it's personal. The ride back to town seems quieter than the ride out. My mother and sister are still getting used to thin air, and the hike tired them out. I ask Dad to drop me on Park Street so I can check out Dan Bailey's, a famous fly fishing shop. Dad says, "Could you grab some feathers? Lil's tying some new flies." He tells me what to buy, something called a rooster cape, and gives me a $20 bill. I spend almost no time in Bailey's shop because it's not really why I wanted to get out of the truck. The true reason is that I'd spotted the bashed-up Range Rover parked on a side street. Approaching the car, I try to act casual, but as soon as I see the trophy husband bumper sticker, I'm ready to jump out of my skin. A pair of dirty feet extends from the only window not covered by a garbage bag. The feet are medium-sized and attached to a person sprawled in the back seat. I keep on strolling to the end of the block, turn around, and go back. To the dirty feet, I say, "Excuse me?" The feet don't move. From where I stand, I can't see the features of the person they belong to.
"Yo!"
I call out.
"What?" "Go away,"
croaks a groggy male voice. "Are you okay?"
"So now it's a federal crime to take a nap?"
"I was worried you might be sick." Somehow I make these words sound totally sincere. The dirty feet withdraw from the window, and a long, unshaven face appears. The man's mussed hair is gray at the temples, one of his top teeth is missing, and his nose is as straight as a pencil. "You're not even him," I say.
"Not who?"
"A friend of my father's drives one of these SUVs. Same color, same model." The man squints at me doubtfully.
"So happens I just bought this thing yesterday, Junior. $900 as is. Every dollar I had to my name, but hey, it's a flippin' Rover. We're talking like $80,000 brand new. All it needs is a little body work."
I'm thinking, a little? More like a whole new body.
"Once it's all fixed up, I can resell her for like 50-60 grand, he declares. "Then I'm set for life."
Okay. I'm not an expert on the resale market for rebuilt luxury vehicles, but the barefoot man sounds way too optimistic. "The person who sold you the car, he was real tan and had a crooked nose, right?" The stranger scowls.
"I don't pay attention to noses. But yeah, the dude was tan. A rich guy tan, though, not a working man's tan. Also, he had some serious Hollywood hair."
"The tips all dyed blonde?"
"Yeah. What's up with that?"
"Lincoln Baxter's his name."
"Yeah, that's what it said on the paperwork," the stranger says. "When I see him park this thing all dented to crap, I go over and ask, did he drive off a cliff or what? He says, 'You want to buy it?' I say, 'Seriously?' And he says, 'How much cash you got, bro?' So I run and get all the money from out of my sleeping bag, and he signs over the title right there on Calendar Street."
The man yawns and swigs from a liter bottle of Mountain Dew.
What time is it anyway? Whoa, I forgot. There's a sweet clock with a second hand right on the dash. Check it out.
I didn't feel the need to tell him I'd already sat in his SUV or the circumstances. Did Mr. Baxter say what happened to this thing?
He said he drove through a hailstorm. Never saw it coming.
Epic fail, I say.
Bad luck for him. Good luck for me.
The barefoot man's expression clouds as a new thought occurs to him.
Listen, Junior. You tell your daddy's pal it's too late to change his mind on this deal. We ain't in California. This is Park County, Montana, where a handshake's a handshake.
Don't worry, I say. He doesn't want this car back. Walking to Geyser Street, I pass a two-story brick house with a wooden tool shed off to one side. Small, sleek birds with curved wings are swooping in and out beneath the overhang of the shed's pitched roof. On my first float down the Yellowstone, I saw the same kind of birds. Summer identified them as cliff swallows. She said they use their beaks to collect wet dirt and mold it into nests that stick to the walls of rock canyons, bridges, and buildings. The grown-up swallows zoom all over, snatching flies and mosquitoes in midair, then carry them back to the baby birds inside the mud nests. But that's only part of what's happening at the wooden shed beside the brick house. Black ravens are gathering along the edge of the roof. I count five of them, standing in a row. They are surprisingly tall, larger than some Florida hawks, and their loud calls of "craw, craw, craw" are nagging and obnoxious. They hop one-footed from side to side, cocking their blue-black heads as they study the swallows coming and going. The little birds know the deal. Occasionally, they peel off and dive-bomb the tall, noisy birds, trying to drive them away. Of course, the ravens aren't going anywhere. They're hungry, but they're patient. They can hear the baby swallows cheeping in their mud cribs. This is nature, right? Harsh things happen. Some people believe it's wrong to interfere in the wild cycle of life and death. I get that. Every living creature has a place in the food chain. But it's impossible to just stand here with my hands in my pockets watching those five sneaky ravens, knowing what they've got in mind. Just like it's impossible for my dad to look the other way and do nothing while an outlaw aims a gun at a bear or a panther. Except there's an important difference between a common raven and a poacher like Lincoln Baxter. One is part of the natural world, and one is a criminal intruder. The bird kills for food, while Baxter kills for entertainment. Either way, it's nothing I really want to see. So I snatch up a handful of rocks and make a long, high throw. They clatter on the roof of the shed, flushing the ravens. In a mad flurry of wings, the flock takes off, craw, craw, crawing above the cottonwoods until it's out of sight. The swallows go back to gobbling insects and tending the young in their mud nests. Ravens have wickedly sharp memories, so I'm sure they'll return to try again another day. By then, maybe the baby birds will have sprouted enough feathers to fly away on their own. I hope so, because I can't hang around here to stand guard. Nature always gets the last word. That's not my line. I read it in a magazine article written by a rock climber. His point was that nature is as cold-hearted as it is beautiful, and that forces beyond our understanding can deliver a random life-or-death surprise at any moment. It might be a landslide, a flash flood, or a bolt of lightning on a cloudless morning. Or if you're a baby swallow, a hungry raven. I don't want my father to get surprised by Lincoln Baxter, so I plan to inform him that the poacher no longer owns that fancy Range Rover. The information isn't very useful, unfortunately, because I've got no clue what kind of vehicle Baxter is driving now. He might be in a Prius,
a minivan, a Winnebago, a Ferrari, anything with wheels. Since Dad won't know what to look out for, Baxter should have an easy time following him, if that's actually his plan. And assuming otherwise could be disastrous. Dad keeps saying the poacher doesn't know who he is or where he lives, but there's a chance he's wrong. Just because Baxter isn't a cop doesn't mean he has no way to identify the owner of the Chevy King cab that trailed him to Tom Minor Basin. While he was slashing Dad's tires, he could have photographed the license numbers and texted them to somebody he knows in law enforcement, maybe one of his hunting buddies, who could sneak on the state computer, and boom! And even though the pickup is registered in Lil's name, the poacher would then have a county, a city, and a home address. He could show up on Lil's doorstep one day when Dad isn't home. I'm not saying that's what will happen, but we really have no idea how much Baxter knows or what he's doing here. My father can't afford to underestimate him. Back at the house on Geyser, Dad is on his knees in the living room, adjusting the blades on his new quadcopter. I wave and step past on my way to Summer's bedroom, where I shut the door and say, "Lincoln Baxter's in town." "Please don't tell me that, Billy." "Well, it's true." I describe my encounter with the barefooted dude who purchased the poacher's SUV and offer my license plate theory about how Baxter ended up in Livingston. Summer's response, "We need to tell my mom." "Everything? She'll freak." Then the door opens. It's Dad. Summer and I freeze.
"Have you seen Belinda?"
he asks. She's at the grocery store," Summer says, "with her mom." She and I are as stiff as scarecrows. Dad gives us a narrow look.
"What's wrong, guys?"
"We need to talk," I say. "All of us together."
"Okay, so let's talk. You go first."
"Not without Lil."
"No, Billy, now wait a minute."
"Follow me," Summer snaps. "Both of you." I'm only one step behind her. Dad's two steps behind me. Summer leads us downstairs to the basement, where classical music is playing. Lil sits at a small table tying chicken feathers to a tiny fish hook clamped to a slim steel vise. She wears round, rimless magnifying glasses. When she sees us, she puts down the tweezer-like tool she's using to wrap the wispy strands on the shank of the hook.
"What's the occasion?" she asks.
Summer glances anxiously at me. Lil eyes us over the top of her glasses.
"Did you all come down here because you're fans of Mozart, or because you've got something to tell me?"
I hand her the package I got at Dan Bailey's. She spreads the rooster cape on the table, saying, "That's a beauty, Billy. Thank you." Summer nudges me from behind. My father gives a slight, stern shake of his head, not a warning so much as a plea. "Sorry, Dad, but the deal's off. I can't keep your secret anymore. The stakes are too high."
"It doesn't take three people to carry a bag of feathers down the stairs," Lil says. "So somebody, please speak up."
Slowly, I raise my hand, like we're in algebra class or something. Lil turns off the music. Now the basement is as quiet as, well, a basement. "Dad doesn't really work for the government," I say. His shoulders sag. Summer looks down at her shoelaces. It's possible I've actually stopped breathing. Lil calmly takes off her glasses. "Oh, Billy, I know that," she says. "I've known for a long time." 18. She had discovered the truth on a frigid January day when Summer was at school, Dad was on a trip, and the river was full of ice. A person called the house identifying himself as a lawyer in the Bahamas. It was the same man Summer would later speak to about Hubert the parrot.
The lawyer told Lil he was updating some legal papers regarding the money from Dad's Aunt Sophie, and he needed to double-check the mailing address in Montana. Lil didn't know what he was talking about, so she asked, "And how is dear Aunt Sophie these days?"
Actually, she's deceased," the flustered lawyer replied. "Didn't Mr. Dickens tell you?"
By the end of the conversation, Lil knew far more than the lawyer should have told her. Yet she didn't say a word to Dad. Instead, she decided to tail him on one of his missions. After leaving Summer with a relative in Billings, Little Thunder Sky spent 17 hours tracking my father through knee-deep snow in the Absaroka Mountains. He had no clue that somebody was spying on him while he was spying on a poacher, or that the somebody was his very own wife. Hidden by a hillside boulder, Lil watched through binoculars while Dad sent his quadcopter to dive-bomb a trophy bull elk, causing it to bound into the heavy timber moments before the poacher's bullet would have struck. Lil crept away and returned home, torn about how to deal with the situation. As risky as Dad's drone expeditions might be, she understood that protecting those animals was a passion, something that gave him a sense of duty. There are worse hobbies a man could have, she thought.
"So I decided to let you keep thinking your secret was safe," Lil says to Dad. "But enough's enough."
He winces like he stepped on a rusty nail.
"I am really, really, really sorry," he says. His face shows regret and also relief that he no longer needs to lie about his mystery missions.
Lil isn't mad, but she's far from happy. We've already told her about the Panther expedition and the possibility that Baxter came here to settle the score with Dad. She says,
"Dennis, I figured you were going to Florida just to see your kids, and I was cool with that. You should have done it a long time ago. But now I find out you took Summer and Billy along while you chased some armed psycho through the Everglades. Have you totally lost your mind?"
I jump in. "That wasn't all Dad's fault. We didn't give him a choice."
"Oh, he had a choice."
Lil's cutting stare swings from Dad toward me and Summer.
"He is a full-grown, functioning adult. It's his job to be in charge of himself."
My father says, "She's right. I took you two along because I was afraid you'd spill the beans if I didn't. But listen, Lil, you know I'd never put these kids in any danger. Baxter didn't know he was being followed until we wanted him to know.
And we never got close enough for him to see us," I add,
Summer nodding at my side. We both feel guilty about our sneaky role in the Everglades trip.
Lil says, "None of us can be sure what this creep is capable of doing. It's time to call the sheriff."
Dad raises his hands in protest.
"And tell him what? A man sold his beat-up SUV to some stranger on the street. That's not a crime. Being in the same town with me isn't a crime either. We've got no proof Baxter came here for revenge. He hasn't made a single threat to me or to any of you."
"He sliced your tires," Summer pipes up, "and shot a hole in your truck."
"Yeah, but we can't prove that was him," Dad says. "The sheriff's going to listen to our story and basically shrug."
He's right, and Lil knows it.
"Fine," she says, "but the kids and Christine need to leave right away, just in case."
"Now, hold on a second," Lil cuts him off.
"No discussion, no debate. It's too risky for them to stay, even if there's only a 1% chance this guy's coming after you."
My father looks whipped. He's got no ammunition for an argument.
"So what am I supposed to tell Chrissy and Belinda?"
"I don't know, Dennis. Truth-twisting is not my department." Lil sits forward, eyeing me in Summer.
"We don't want to alarm Billy's mom and sister, so you two come up with a good creative excuse why we've got to cut short the family visit."
Summer says, "Grandma got real sick, and we've got to drive up to the reservation?"
my suggestion. The government called Dad for an emergency drone assignment in, like, Utah?
Lil nods.
Sounds good. We'll use both those stories. Dad stands there wilted and depressed. His only comment, it sucks to do this. On that, we all agree. This one kid, he got kicked out of school because he brought a BB pistol. The gun wasn't loaded, but he still got expelled. That's the rule. They warn students at the start of every year, no weapons of any kind, period. The kid was in two of my classes. Jervis was his name. He was a pretty good student, had never been in trouble before. They didn't tell us why he'd brought the pistol to school, but I found out the reason. Some fool was messing with him on the bus ride home, almost every afternoon. The other kid's name was Tickmore. For real, Timmy Tickmore. He wasn't much bigger than Jervis, but he was loud and mean and dumber than a mud fence. You know the type. He didn't throw punches, but he specialized in using his elbows and knees. Sometimes he'd stomp on somebody's foot and then laugh when he saw how much it hurt. One afternoon, Tickmore elbowed Jervis in the back of the neck and told him he was going to do something bad to Jervis's little sister when she got old enough to ride the bus. Cut off all her hair or throw her books out the window, whatever. When Jervis went home from school that day, he took the BB pistol from the garage and hid it in his book bag. It was a cheap target gun that could barely shoot a hole in a soda can, but it looked like a real 9mm. Jervis's idea was to flash it at Timmy Tickmore, scaring him so much that he'd promised to leave Jervis's little sister alone. Obviously, it was a terrible plan, something only a frightened and desperate person would try. In addition to being frightened and desperate, Jervis was also unlucky. The same morning he brought the BB pistol to school, there was a random locker search. You can guess what happened. After finding the gun, Officer Thickley called Jervis's parents to come get him, and that afternoon, he was officially kicked out of school. He never rode the bus again, never saw Tickmore again, and never told the principal why he was carrying that stupid BB pistol. But he told me. A week after the locker search, I saw him in the dairy aisle at the supermarket. When he recounted what had happened, he didn't sound bitter. He just sounded defeated. That night, I locked the door to my room, opened my laptop, and typed a letter to the school. The letter said I needed to ride bus number 537 for one day because I'd be staying with an uncle on that pickup route while my mother was out of town for a funeral. Then I signed Mom's name to the letter, Christine Jane Dickens. I even put a double dot over the last I, the same way she does. I know, it was weaselly, dishonest, and totally wrong, though not as wrong as what Timmy Tickmore did to Jervis. The letter I wrote to the school looked super legit. I took it to the office, and with no hesitation, Mrs. Lipton gave me a yellow pass to get on the bus. She didn't call Mom to double-check because she didn't want to bother her before the non-existent funeral. "Please tell her we're so sorry for her loss," Mrs. Lipton said sincerely. "That's very kind of you," I replied. Problem solved. The next morning, I woke up early, walked to Jervis's bus stop, and waited with the other kids for number 537. I knew from talking with Jervis that Tickmore boarded at one of the earlier stops and always took the bench seat in the back of the bus. That's straight where I headed after handing my permission slip to the driver. Tickmore was sitting with two kids who looked equally brainless. "Could you guys scoot over?" I asked nicely.
"What?"
cackled one of the nitwits. "I need to sit next to Timmy."
"Yeah? How come?"
snarled the second nitwit. "Because I've got some key information for him. What they call a game changer." Tickmore looked at me warily.
Aren't you the dude they call Snake Boy?
Immediately, Nitwit 1 slid over on the seat. I sat down between him and Tickmore. My backpack was on my lap.
What you talking about? You got information, Tickmore said, trying to sound like he wasn't interested. I never seen you on this bus before.
That's right. You've never seen me at 1728 Mango Lane, either. That's where he and his family lived. It was easy to find the address. They were the only Tickmores in the city phone book.
Timmy, what's the reptile situation in your neighborhood? I asked.
He clenched up and began to squirm. I mean, physically squirm, like a slug on a hot sidewalk. He was extremely nervous, but he didn't want to look like a wimp in front of his friends.
You must like pain, he said, working his face into a sneer.
It was actually comical.
Pretend I'm Jervis, I whispered to him. Stomp on my feet. Slap me in the head. Hey, you can even jab me in the neck with your elbow. Go on, don't be scared.
Nitwit 2 howled.
Dude, the Timinator's not scared of nothing.
Tickmore's forehead got pink and sweaty. He started looking around the bus for other seating options. I didn't mind watching him tremble, the way he made other kids tremble. Leaning sideways into him, I said,
Yo, check this out.
I lifted my backpack and shook it lightly from side to side, like a bag of popcorn. Tickmore and the two nitwits were mystified.
Listen close, Timmy, I said.
Inside the backpack, something started to rattle. It was a sound made by only one creature in all of nature. Tickmore's phony sneer disappeared, and his eyes got wide. No sudden moves, I advised. Even if he'd wanted to, Tickmore couldn't move a muscle. Fear bolted him to his seat. Every time the rattling stopped, I'd shake the backpack again. By the time we arrived at school, Tickmore and I had reached an understanding. If I heard about him bothering anybody on that bus, or anybody in the halls, or anybody in the cafeteria, or anybody in the gym, or anybody anywhere, there would be serious snakes in his future. As he bounded for the exit door, he was clutching his books low in front of his pants. I assumed that he'd peed himself. Maybe I'm an awful person, but I still didn't feel sorry for him, not after what he did to Jervis. You're probably thinking, what kind of maniac gets on the school bus carrying a live rattlesnake? Not me, don't worry. Hidden in a side pocket of my backpack was my cell phone, cued to a slither tube post of a real 6-foot diamondback shaking the rattle on its tail. Every time I jostled the backpack, I'd slip a hand inside the zipper and tap the play button. Even with the volume only halfway up, the noise was impressive. Tickmore's nitwit peeps practically climbed over his shoulders in their rush to flee the bus. The point of the story is that while honesty is a good thing, lying is occasionally necessary in order to protect people. I wrote a totally bogus letter and forged my mother's signature just to get on bus number 537 so I could deal with Timmy Tickmore. And though I never actually told him there was a real rattlesnake coiled inside my backpack, I definitely made him think there was. So that's basically two lies, which is nothing to be proud of. On the other hand, nobody at my school has to worry about that creep anymore. He won't mess with any other kids the way he did with Jervis. And now, I've got a few more lies to tell if I want to make sure Mom and Belinda go straight home to Florida, safe from anything bad that might happen here.
My pics of the Golden didn't turn out so fabulous, my mother remarked, scrolling through the photo file on her phone. In the pictures, the distant eagle looks like a chunky brown post planted on the side of the cliff.
But you saw one. That's all that matters, I told her. She beamed.
And it was awesome, Billy. better than awesome. Awesome squared.
Then came the hard part. Mom, I've got some bad news. I deliver the two phony stories that Lil's mother is ill on the Crow Reservation and that my father is being called away on another government mission. We'll have to go home earlier than we planned, I said. She was really disappointed, but she said she understood.
I hope it's nothing serious with Summer's grandma, she added.
Me too. Dad's rebooking our flight to Florida.
I'll tell your sister in a minute.
Mom went back to studying her golden eagle photos.
You know what I'm wondering, Billy? Where was this bird's mate?
Probably back at the nest, I assured her, feeding their little ones.
Of course, that makes sense. I bet you're right.
The next morning, it was still dark when Dad dropped us at the Bozeman Airport. Mom gave him a proper peck on the cheek, and that's all. She gets the whole Montana thing now, and seems honestly okay with Dad's new life, what she calls his second act. Even Belinda offered a hug. Waving goodbye, he looked sad enough to be going to a real funeral. All that was missing was his grim black suit. Now I'm sitting in seat 9C, wondering how much my ticket cost, and, since the airline doesn't do refunds, how long it will take me to pay him back. When Dad rebooked our flight, he couldn't get us three seats together, so Belinda is four rows behind me. She's still sulking because my mother wouldn't buy her a $300 pair of hand-stitched cowgirl boots. Mom is sitting five rows farther back, dozing with a book on her lap. Meanwhile, my eyes are locked on the no-nonsense flight attendant holding the microphone at the front of the plane. He's been patiently telling passengers to please clear the aisles, buckle up, and get ready for takeoff. He'll say it once more right before he closes the cabin door. I know the drill because I went online and found a Delta Airlines flight attendant training manual. So, the moment I hear the words over the intercom, I undo my lap belt and march up the aisle. The flight attendant thinks I'm going to the restroom. He tells me I have to wait in my seat until after the aircraft takes off and reaches cruising altitude. I nod agreeably, slide past him, and dart out the cabin door.
Stop! You can't get off now! He calls after me. I left something at the gate. But they won't let you reboard!
Exactly. Technically, what I told the flight attendant wasn't a lie. I really did leave my carry-on at the gate, accidentally on purpose. The bag is still under the seat where I put it. As soon as I'm out of the terminal building, I text Mom with another fake story.
I forgot my bag in the airport. They wouldn't let me back on the plane.
All okay now. I'll catch a flight home tomorrow. Call you later. Either she is still asleep, or she's already turned off her phone, because I don't get a response to my text. The cab ride to Livingston costs way more than the $13 in my wallet, so the driver parks in front of Dad's house to wait. Summer has a toothbrush in her mouth when she comes to the door.
What in the world are you doing here?
Can I borrow some money for the taxi? The cash comes from Lil's cookie jar stash, and the driver leaves happy. Summer doesn't fall for my story of how I missed the flight.
You came back here because of Baxter, right? Well, guess what, Billy Big Stick? We were wrong, you and me.
Wrong about what?
He's not stalking Dennis, she says.
And you know this how?
Your dad got a call from Mrs. Baxter this morning. She said her hubby came here to shoot a grizzly.
Hold on. Baxter admitted that to his wife? That he's poaching?
Of course not, but he had her FedEx one of his big rifles to the Murray Hotel. He made up a story that it's broken and the best gunsmith is here in Livingston.
Total bull, I say.
Exactly. Dennis says it's strictly a bear gun, too. I called the hotel pretending to be Baxter's assistant, and they said the package was delivered this morning.
Where's Dad now?
On his way down to Tom Minor, Summer says.
I don't like anything I'm hearing. Baxter didn't need to trace Dad's license tag to get his name.